See, from a soul's point of view, you just see karma unfolding. What are you going to do about it, you know? I'll say what I'll say. You'll hear what you'll hear. You'll hear what you need to hear. I'll say what I need to say. You learn how not to buy into other people's projections of what they think reality is. Most of us are going down the street like Dr. Strange comics with these huge nets over our head, which are full of thoughts saying, this is who I think I am, this is who I think you are, this is how it is, this is who I think I am, this is who I think you are, this is how it is. And you're, you know, this is how I think it is, this is who you are, this is how I am, this is how it is.
This is who I think I am, this is who you think you are.
You know, it's extraordinary. I mean, if you just quiet down for a minute and look at who you meet on the street, everybody thinks they're somebody. I mean, they don't think they're just somebody. They think they're exclusively somebody. I got nothing against them being somebody, as long as they're an equal amount of nobody. So I say what I say because I say it, because it's the best I can say it in my intention to communicate Dharma. What you hear is what you hear. If my attachment is to what you hear, I will be miserable. Because I walk out in the corridor and I hear people saying, wasn't it wonderful how he said, and they say just the opposite of what I said. Yeah. That could freak somebody if you were attached to the outcome. But in doing Dharma, in doing acts dharmically, you learn you do the thing as well as you can do it, and then what happens, happens. It's not all under my control. How can I control all the karmic stuff you got and all the karmic stuff I've got? So from a soul's point of view, now, just a technical thing for those of you that would like this technical. The rest of you, just ignore it. This is really for just a few people. It's like an in joke. The soul is what, from my, this is out of my ignorance, okay? The soul is what carries karma. It's like psychic DNA that it carries over vast amounts of time. And along the way, it keeps manifesting in different forms, like dreams, bodies, all that stuff, to, quote, work out karma. Because the karma is what keeps you with attractions and aversions, which is the root of the cause of the suffering that comes from the ignorance that thinks you're separate. My father bought for 2 zuzim. That's an in joke. So the soul is passing through some vast time frame, very, very, from our point of view here, this kind of vast, vast time frame. I'll just play with it, because I know reincarnation is still a hot issue in the West. But, and it's really an illusion, but it's a useful illusion. So I'll use it, just like the soul is a useful illusion, as I'll point out in a minute. So over these vast times, like the Buddha, when asked, how long have you been doing this, meaning this, was apocryphally, was supposedly said, if you take the distance a water buffalo walks in one day, it's about 6 miles, take a mountain 6 miles long, 6 miles wide, 6 miles high, and every 100 years you run a bird flies over the mountain with a silk scarf, in the length of time it would take the silk scarf to wear away the mountain. That's how long you've been doing this. Do you have any sense of vastness in that? I mean, this whole life of, what shall I do? What's my career? Should I marry? Shouldn't I marry? Oh my God, I've got cancer. Oh, ooh, ah, ah. That's all like those little bugs that are, they are born in the morning and they die at night around noon. They say, this is life, you know? I mean, they're... It's like, it's all a perspective matter. So in a way, this kind of soul is just drifting through with all this stuff that keeps manifesting. And then each lifetime is really the manifestation of your karmic predispositions. And that affects how you see reality, what reality you create. Because your reality is created by the projections of your own attractions and aversions. Like if three of us are in a car and we're going through a village and one of us is hungry, one of us is horny, and one of us is driving the car and hears the engine isn't working well, at the other end of town, if you say to the three of us, what was in the town? One will say there was a McDonald's, and one will say there was somebody interesting under the clock, and one will say there was a garage at the corner. Because motivation affects perception. We all know that. Even straight people know that. Take that out a few levels into metaphysics land, and any attraction or aversion colors your perception of reality. It's why in the mystic literature it says, truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. When you long for something, you only see, if I want something really badly, I begin to see all of you as relevant only to the extent you can gratify that need. And you become objects in my universe to be manipulated to gratify that need because I identified with that need or desire. And the awakening is realizing that you are trapped in your own identification with your own separateness and all of its needs, desires, opinions, attitudes. The third Chinese patriarch, one of the great, great texts of the universe, it's called the Sin Sin Ming, starts out with the great way, capital G, capital W, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Ready? Ready? I mean, forget vanilla and chocolate ice cream. Try life and death. And when you realize, when you see how funny, how wild it is, that all this words we bandy about like unconditional love, you couldn't give unconditional love unless you don't want anything. If you want anything, your love is in some way conditional. There's no way you can get out of it. Even if you want to stay alive. So only a liberated being could be unconditional love. Everyone else is conditional. And just as an aside, what I met in Neem Karoli Baba was a being who was so cooked, whose awareness was so free of identity, exclusive identity with separateness, that I experienced that love as unconditional. And it released something inside of me. And if I could spend my life becoming that quality of unconditional love for other human beings, what an incredible gift. What grace to be able to be an instrument through which another being can become free of their paranoia. Because that's really what we're talking about. The paranoia of separateness that we all carry with us all the time. And it's interesting that what you realize after a while is you work on yourself, and when people say, oh, how narcissistic, working on yourself, you understand that you have seen the relationship. You work on yourself so that you can reduce the amount of suffering you create through your actions. But then you say, well, how will I work on myself to open myself to soul awareness and to stabilize myself so that I can sit in my soul, my karma unfolding around me. There goes my life. There goes my death. Ah, there's my children. Ah, there's my work. Ah, so, ah. From that place. All the time, you are not pushing away your life, but not only enjoying it, but celebrating it, but feeling it's a joyful, creative manifestation, the way you live your life. And delighting in it passionately. How can you be passionately involved in life and at the same moment it is totally empty? See, it's interesting that most of us don't think it's possible to embrace what seem like paradoxes. But these are not logical paradoxes. They're not within the mind. They are planes of consciousness in which more across planes you live with the tension that different things are also true. From the soul's point of view, because what dies and what grows old has to do with body, it has to do with personality, it has to do with thought, it has to do with sensations. And it will die. And if that's who you think you are literally scared up until you die. Because when you die, you don't exist. And most of this society deals with death with massive denial or obsession. All the amount of energy around capital punishment, abortion, assisted suicides, violent deaths, the numbers of murders per installment on television. We have a death obsession that comes out of a rich, rich world of denial. That's fascinating. Yeah. And that's because we are so locked into our ego identities. Now, as you awaken to another plane of reality, to a larger context, to another place, which is in all of us, and you start to exist as a soul, the interesting thing about it is the soul drops the body. In other words, from a soul point of view, you don't die. You say, oh, here I come. Oh, there I went. Well, there goes that one. Now, what'll I do next time? I'm just making it charming, but this is all straight, spiritual, you know, traditional stuff. This isn't anything I'm making up. Once you stabilize in soul awareness, then another process starts to become stronger in you, which is the yearning of the soul to merge back into God, awareness, Allah, Om, Nibbanic state, the Tao, on and on across systems. It's the yearning of the separate entity to merge with the beloved, which is the totality. It's what all of the poetry of Rumi and Hafiz and Kabir and yum, 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 all these wonderful, and the Psalms and the songs, these are all about that yearning of the soul to return to the One. Practice traditions, that one is called the state like of pure awareness, for example. It's where you have returned into that part of your being or that quality that is pure awareness, which has embraced all the rest of it. So awareness is, instead of standing inside the separate entity of soul, I now am merging back into the totality. What happens to soul? Well, ego's still driving the car, soul's still witnessing, and awareness is just embracing it all. In other words, every time you transcend a level, it doesn't mean it goes away, it just means you are not exclusively identified with it anymore, but it's still around. So they say, before Satori you chop wood and carry water, and after Satori you chop wood and carry water. From outside, nothing interesting has happened. You're perfectly ordinary. But from inside, it's an entirely different game. So take aging. When I was 60, because I had lived in cultures like India, At 60, you're supposed to give up the world and totally be with the Spirit. So I thought, okay, here I go. Ram Dass, 60, here we go. So I'll have a lot of birthday parties, so I'll really be symbolic of the ritual of change, and I'll let go of everything. 6 months later, I saw that was all a mind trip. I was busier than ever, just as full of my ego. It was clear that one wasn't going to work. So I decided I would be no age for a while longer, and until it caught up with me. At 62, I was on a train going from Westport, Connecticut to New York City. It was autumn, and we had just been through that riotous ecstasy of leaves that you appreciate. And I live in California where they don't have that. It's just, it's like a deprived area. It's like a desert. So I was on the train. You had to buy your ticket on the train. And I was sitting there just enjoying the day and how beautiful the leaves had been. And the conductor comes through and he says, "Tickets, please." And I said, "I'll have to buy my ticket from you." He says, "What kind do you want?" So I said, "What choice do I have?" So he said, "Regular or senior?" So I said to him, "Senior?" And I heard the way I said it. It was the same way when I was 18 years old and I went into New York State for my first beer. I said, "Beer?" Like, "Are you really going to serve me?" And he gave me this ticket and he walked on down the aisle. And I said, "How much is this?" He said, $4.50. I said, "What's the regular one?" He says, $7. That's good. But as he walked away and I held that ticket and it said in prominent letters, "Senior," I realized that $2.50 might be very costly. It might be costing more than it was worth because it felt creepy. Is that, am I conveying what that feeling was? I mean, it just like, yee, I don't think I want this. You know? I mean, this was now, I had a legitimate, you know, approved definition of myself. The society saw me as this old fart, you know? I mean, I had suddenly just lost it, just like that, you know? And it didn't feel good at all. And over the next while, I started to play with this issue. I started to look at why it felt so crummy. And also recognize that for the last 33 years, I had been busy using my practices to change my consciousness so that I would not be trapped in any of the definitions of reality. But this one was one I'd never even noticed, which was the aging one, and I might as well try to integrate all I'd been doing for 35 years with this experience of aging, because otherwise I was going to slide down a kind of a slippery path into being what the culture defined as an old person. And when I looked at what the culture defined as an old person, I mean, you have this bizarre set of circumstances. I mean, just look at television and see how old people are portrayed as trivial, silly, stubborn, you know, dependent in a pejorative sense. And then you look at the youth orientation of this culture. Look at all the advertising. Look at all the ways youth is portrayed. Look at how our role models of old people are people who act young. Isn't that bizarre? I went to India after a while, and after I started thinking about this issue, and I was up in a village in India that I spend a lot of time with, and one of my dear friends came down the street. He said, "Ram Dass," and he hugged me, and he stood back. He says, "You're looking much older." And I went, "Ooh," you know, like, my culture caught me, you see. And then I heard how he was saying it. And he was saying it with respect. I mean, imagine that. "You're older, we can trust you now," or whatever. Bob Dole had only been in that culture. I in no way, I mean, I really, I have opinions about the recent election, but I won't put them now till the question-answer period, but... And so this doesn't come out of, it's just, this is just a very funny thing. It's not out of any judgment. Bill Clinton had been asked, do you wear briefs or shorts? And so Bob Dole was asked the same question. Do you wear briefs or shorts, Senator Dole? And he answered, depends. If you don't understand, ask somebody next to you. They'll. My understanding of what we are doing on Earth is that we are working out the karma of our souls, and the job is for us to awaken and remain awakened and become free. And that will take as long as it will take. And once we are free, then we are in a position to be an environment through which other people can become free, and our acts free other people. And that, so you work on yourself as a gift to other people. And since you can't wait to be free to do anything for people, you do what you do because you experience that it's all splinter in the other finger. It's all our suffering, and you respond with our compassion. And you do this all as a practice to work on yourself to become free. So that I serve in order to become free, I try to become free in order to be able to serve without creating more suffering. You can feel the way this whole dance of work in the world and acknowledging and deepening your spiritual identity starts to play off of each other, constantly playing off of each other. Our job is to awaken out of ego, not in any sense to put down the exquisiteness of ego, of the physical, psychological plane, of our senses, of our thinking minds, which are these beautiful prefrontal powers that we have. Not to put it down, but to free us from the exclusivity of it. That's all. We're just moving from being looking at the world from only one place to developing the capacity to simultaneously see the world in another way. Like, I'm working with a woman now. I do this as my delight in life. I work with people who are dying. Now that's part of, I mean, if you do not have a soul identity and you're only in your ego, working with dying people isn't much fun. And you say, don't talk about it, don't think about it, I don't want to have anything to do with it. I can't, how could you do that? From a soul's point of view, it is absolutely the leading edge of the way you can work on yourself. Because you're dealing with the deepest first chakra fear that human beings have, including yourself, of your own death, and you're getting as close to death as you can and trying to stay as open as you can in the presence of it. So I am with this woman. I was just talking to her about a couple of hours ago. She has three children, 16, 14, and 10. She's 40, I think 8 or so. Her husband's a dentist, and they live in Northern California, and she now has, starting with, I think, breast cancer, I'm not sure, she has metastasized cancer through her whole body, and she's on considerable amounts of morphine, and she will probably die within the next 3-4 days. So I dial a number, and I call, and I say hello to whoever answers. This is Ram Dass, and they say, just a minute, please. And suddenly, there she is on the other end. Hello. Hi, Ram Dass. Now, I'm not a doctor in that kind of sense of a doctor, I have nothing to offer in terms of cures for her physical condition. What is my value to this woman? What suffering is she experiencing, and can I be an environment through which she can become free of that suffering? If she wants to. See, you realize you have no moral right to die another's death for them. You know, if you were a good Buddhist, you would be doing this in preparation for your death. How presumptuous of me to know how another person should die. It's their karma, not mine. I'm just creating a space. So if I call and she is caught in her pain and in her dying and in her fear of losing her children and in her love for her husband and in all of that stuff, she says, "Oh, Ram Dass, I'm so happy to talk to you." And what she's happy about is that she knows, she feels my heart empathetic with her predicament, and your heart breaks at such a predicament in another human being. How could it not? And at the same moment, she feels that I am not caught in it. It's like, hey, you in there? I'm in here. What are you doing in that one? And that one is a body dying of cancer. In other words, I am available to her as a fellow soul. And the only way I can do that is if I do not get so seduced by the horror of her predicament and the pain and all of it that I lose that plane of my own consciousness. And often, and I do this all the time, and I can't tell you how, if I don't want anything, if I don't want a person to come up for air unless they want to, the minute I want to, forget it. But if I am just present for a person and working on myself to be there on both of those planes of consciousness, the soul and the ego, again and again, a person is, whew, wow. Boy, this is interesting. It's hard. But we meet in a place in which we are both appreciating and reflecting of the mystery of suffering and the mystery of death. We meet around the edge of the mystery of the universe. Because it isn't given to the soul to even understand the whole thing. The soul is only part of it. You can't understand it, you can only be it in the final plane of awareness. But she and I, just a few hours ago, were sitting right behind the whole thing. And she was saying, well, you know, what's been catching me now is the unexpected pain. So I asked that the morphine be increased a little bit, but she said, I'm trying to keep my consciousness clear. I mean, what exquisite, what an evolved being to be able to reflect at that level, at that moment. And I'm saying, you know, yay. Wow, here we are. I said, you thinking much about death? See, how many people would ask that? It's like a no-no. I remember when my mother was dying, everybody came in the room, said, Gert, you're looking better, the doctor has new medicines, and then they go out in the corridor and say she won't live the week. Can you imagine somebody is facing the entrance into the deepest mystery of the universe and is surrounded by deception? Do you realize how frightened everybody in that room is? And finally, much of the stuff I am helping people that are dying do is learn how to be present for the people that are around them, helping them, to help them get free of being trapped. And she's just getting to the point where she's ready to enter the mystery. Because I'll tell you, I have studied all these traditions, and I'm an intelligent fellow. And when you ask me what happens after death, My answer is, it's a mystery. Because all of the conceptual models, whether they're the heavens and hells of the Judeo-Christian tradition, whether they're the bardos of Tibetan Buddhism, whether they're the mansions of Kabbalah, whether on and on and on, all the different traditions, the Native American realms and all of the things, these are all the conceptual mind imposing something on an experience that was non-conceptual, which is what we're doing all the time. But we just end up with these models of reality, of what happens after death. And I'd say, I don't know what's going to happen. There is no doubt in my mind that because of my direct experiences that I am part of systems much vaster than who I think it is that's dying. But I don't see a conceptual model that satisfies me. So what I'm doing is preparing to be at the edge of the mystery as I die. And I'd like to be clear. I would like to enjoy adventure. I would like to have my heart open. I would like to be surrounded by people who are helping me do this instead of people who are pulling me away from it out of their own fear. So if I could, I would create environments where people could die surrounded by conscious people. But we treat, if you go into a, I just spoke a few weeks ago at Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York. Sloan Kettering is the, it's the almost the penultimate of conservative medical denial. From that point of view, death is an enemy and it represents failure. And when you go to Sloan Kettering, you buy into that mythology that death is an error and a failure. And the horror is that many patients, when they die, feel they failed their doctor. Isn't that bizarre? Here you're approaching the most profound moment of your life. And everybody back there is only on this side. Nobody is recognizing that there's at least another side, even a mystery. All you got to do is say a mystery. Even you rational materialists can say that. I mean, Einstein said, unless you cozy up to the mystery, you're screwed. You're not even alive. He didn't say it that way, but that's what he meant. So I would say that aging, and I've got, I mean, I've just finished a book called Aging Lightly, A Spiritual Paradigm for Conscious Aging, in which I have said the experience of aging can become a curriculum for you through which you can awaken into and stabilize in your soul identity, which doesn't die, without pushing away your ego identity, which dies, and you can dual track it right to the moment of death. And you can use your aging as a set of experiences to keep working on your consciousness to stabilize it in soul awareness. And the funny next level of it is, well, what do you want me to do? Spend all my time preparing to die? Well, when you get into the inner blips of it all, you see that the optimum thing you want to do at the moment of death is be totally present in the moment. Not holding on to who you were or not holding on to a belief of where you're going. Just to be ah. And the best preparation for getting there is to do it now. To be fully in this moment now. I don't mean the relation between two moments. That puts you back in time. I'm talking about the moment, which has no time in it. Moment. 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 When you look at the society, you see older people, as their future gets shorter, and it's full of all kinds of stuff that they think is going to cause suffering, like arthritis and cancer and loss of all your loved ones and all of it, and then dying and then dead. What happens to most people is the fear of all that is so great that the consciousness flips from being future-oriented, which you were through your youth and middle life, you flip into being sentimental and living in your past. And what you miss in that is where the solution is, where the escape hatch is, which is in the present moment. So I would say that the art of aging lightly is to find practices that bring you fully into what is on every plane of consciousness. And you're doing all of that, and slowly you're beginning to understand more and more deeply your identity as a soul, your identity as the one, as awareness, as the spirit. That, to me, is what our curriculum of life is about. To me, aging is merely a little example of that. Because anything you're doing when you finally see what the game is becomes a vehicle for that. Raising children, being on the internet, all of it is what it is, and it's also a vehicle to become free. I'm not saying you don't enjoy the games, but don't get caught in the exclusivity of them. Constantly keep the mindfulness, the awareness, the heart open, realizing that you're in a dance with the beloved, and you're dancing, going slow, closer and closer. This is all to the extent you experience yourself as separate, and you recognize that there is a beloved, there is the one behind the many, you are in the advanced stages of foreplay. And finally comes the moment of orgasm, in which you aren't and it is. I'm 7 minutes over. We will take a break, and then we will come back after a few minutes and have a video, and then a short video, and then we'll have questions and answers. It's a delight to be with you tonight, by the way.